You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, April 5th, 2022, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, everyone.
How are you guys doing?
Good.
Not too bad.
How are you guys doing?
Not bad.
Pretty good.
This is our first show recorded in April. We kind of blew by April 1st this year. I don't know if you guys noticed how, like, April Fool's Day. It's not really a thing anymore. Have you noticed that? Is it just us?
One thing that's not fun about it is, I want to say, so April 1st, what day of the week was that?
Friday.
Monday, I thought? No, it was Friday.
April Fool's.
It was Friday. So I was in Mexico this past weekend, like the second half of the weekend, the weekend. Mm-hmm. And they had their daylight saving and no one told us.
Oh, no. Oops.
So we just, like, lost an hour one night and were so confused as to why the flight times didn't line up on the way there versus on the way back. They were like, so that's kind of an April Fool's joke, but not.
Inadvertently.
Yeah.
I've come to the conclusion, just as one of my life, you know, lesson things, is that, yeah, you know, fooling people is fun for you and never fun for the other people, and it's kind of a dick move.
It is a dick move.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Kind
it?
Of is,
it's just kind of lost all desire to do it.
And it's either, like, not funny or, yeah, it's kind of sad. Like, my friend and I drink a very similar pour-over coffee. I think I might have had you guys try it once when we were traveling together. And they did, the company did, like, an April Fool's email. But they didn't obviously mark it as an April Fool's email. So they were like, you asked and we delivered. Shrimp lattes are now available. And they did a whole thing about these shrimp lattes. And then at the end, they were like, only today. And my friend sent it to me and they were like, this is so gross. Why would they do this? And I was like, because it's April Fool's, idiot. But just like did not even register. Well,
on a certain level, there's so many weird things that go on in the world, it seems, nowadays. It's almost...
It's redundant, right?
It gets lost.
It gets lost, right? Yeah, I mean, it's like an Onion article.
Right. I mean, you can see, look at something any day on the internet and think it's April Fool's Day. Mm-hmm. It's all blended together now.
So I read an article recently, and Kara, you independently found the same article. We finally completed the human genome.
Yeah. No.
Human genome.
No, that happened in 2003.
Yeah, like, wait, did that happen in 2003? No, I
found the article, like, too. It was too boring to mention.
Yeah, it was a little interesting.
I mean, it's a big deal.
When they sequenced the genome, they didn't just sequence the exome, you know, which is just the parts of the genes that get made into proteins. Although, like, if you get, like, a genetic sequence now, that's what they're doing, just the exome. They're not bothering to do all the other stuff. And if you do, like, the swab analysis to the companies for $300, they're just doing a SNP analysis. They're not even sequencing your exome. They're just looking at little markers. But anyway, I thought they did pretty much the whole genome. But there was pieces that they never got to because they were hard, mainly the centromeres and the telomeres.
Oh, telomeres.
Yeah, those are pretty important. And, I mean, I think didn't it account for something like 8% overall?
Yeah,
8%. That's a lot.
Yeah.
So they lied to us 20 years ago.
Yeah, what's the deal with that?
They rounded up.
I feel a little cheated.
If you've read the details, you'd know. But
when we get to that third or fourth paragraph, you know, where they're getting into the details, there's always that little caveat. Although it was only 92% of the actual genome, whatever. And they extrapolated the rest. But now that they have, it's helpful because it's good to know how, like, the centromeres are like the middle of the chromosome,
right.
And that's very important for lining them up and the cell division. And the telomeres, of course, are like the end caps that are. That are important for longevity. You know, they tend to shorten over our lifespan.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And just knowing the structure of the DNA for those, you know, anatomical features, you know, is helpful to understanding how they work.
But not dramatic.
But some of it is, like, legit coding, like this, what they're calling the satellite DNA, kind of repetitive sequences that are really confusing and they weren't really able to figure out back then. Like, I was reading, like, 50 genetic disorders are linked to variations in that satellite DNA over by the telomeres, including Huntington's.
Yeah, so it's not nothing. Yeah,
it's not nothing. Like, it does something. And then there's these transposable ones, these, like, this DNA that can jump around, and that wasn't all fully coded, and lots of mutations there underlie, you know, some genetic disorders.
Yeah.
So there are real biomedical consequences to this as well.
Imagine you've got one of those genetic disorders. And 20 years ago, like, yes, we got the genome. Like, well, we didn't do your areas that you're focused on.
Right,
maybe
right.
In 20 years, we'll get to it. 20 years.
Yeah. 2 weeks. Almost 19 years ago. 19 years.
Yeah, that's amazing. I can't believe 2003 was 19 years ago. Stop.
Yeah,
Stop.
We're effing old.
I definitely have seen an uptick in phishing emails in the last few weeks. Have you guys?
For me, it's been testing.
Oh my God.
It's been texting, Steve.
Emails, time, text messages.
Yeah, definitely. But just there's definitely I've gotten an uptick. That's all I'm saying. You know.
Oh, interesting.
And it's, what kind?
Well, I'm getting.
What are they selling you?
I'm getting a bunch from my bank, but I know they're fake, and because you know it's saying stuff that I absolutely know is not true, and it's always the like. You're about to overdraw. Click now. You know, like I know I'm nowhere near that happening. And now I got one from Coinbase, which is like somebody just tried to withdraw money from your thing. And click now to verify. I'm like,
mine are always like, you want a gift card. I almost never get any from my from like the fake.
Oh, the virtual. I get the virtual currency ones regularly.
Wow, these are the panic clicks. They went, wait a minute, somebody bought something from my account. Hold on now.
Yeah.
Funny.
Don't click nothing.
I don't know if you guys get a similar thing, but I get a ton of emails that are all about like, okay, my bank, Amazon, Home Depot.
Home Depot. I always get the Home Depot gift card ones. Mm-hmm.
Citibank and everything. But the thing is, and it might be because like Gmail is doing something to the email, but it's like they spell out Home Depot, H.O. You know, like it's the title of the business with dots in between the letters
or lowercase H, capital.
Yeah, they're probably trying to get past filters.
Yeah, I was thinking that too. But it's so obvious that it's fake.
I know. It's right? Like they'll catch it in the next.
They
patch.
Only need to get a fraction of a percent of people to click on that thing to pay off. That's
the numbers
it.
Game. And I keep getting like for me the uptick has been in texting. And because I monitor my text much more closely than my damn emails because I get inundated with emails. But so here's a classic one I have just here. Hey, it says, I changed my number. How are you doing? We haven't been in touch for a long time. That's it. Like, oh, yeah. I'm sure this is a friend who doesn't use my name.
And, I've never gotten one of those.
And part of me is like, I'd love to like explore it. Hey, how you doing? Like either play a joke or just try to see what their end game is. When are they and how are they going to try to get my credit card number, basically, or bank information. That's got to be the scam. But I'm just curious how they would do it. But it's just so frustrating. It's like, really, how stupid do you think I am? But I know there's people that fall for it, and it's just like not stupid. It's just like my mom. If my mom saw a text like that, she would fall for that. It's just just not used to it.
Are the most common victims of this stuff?
I don't
just
think
are.
I've
unfortunately,
ever gotten a scammy text before.
Yeah,
I think the only ones that I get are marketing texts about like, do you want to sell your house? And we can send you a good offer, like rebuy your mortgage.
Kara, is that what you think their voices are like?
Yeah.
Do you want to sell your house?
Burp, burp, mortgage. And I'm like, yeah, okay. But I assume that those are just legit marketing. Somehow I ended up on a list somewhere. And
you're on many lists.
Yeah, but those are just marketing. I don't think they're trying to like, I mean, I've never clicked on them, but I don't think they're going to try and like steal all my info. I think they're literally like, we would like to buy your house. Or we would like for you to refi your mortgage with us. And I'm like, no, thanks. It's so funny, too, because everybody's offering these like mortgage deals right now. But have you noticed interest rates aren't as good as they were?
Yeah. Because
so it makes me laugh. Yeah. They're always like, we can get you a 3.7%. And I'm like, that is not good compared to what I have. I don't want that.
Nope.
Stop trying to sell to me.
All right. Well, let's move on to some news items. I'm going to start off with another discussion of life on Europa. Attempts to discover if there's right life on Europa. Bob, let me know if you really understood this. So we know that there's water under the ice of Europa, right? There's actually about twice as much water as there is on the surface of the Earth, under the ice on Europa. That's a massive ocean. Again, twice as big as the oceans on Earth.
And a lot less plastic.
Mm-hmm. We assume. We don't know what's under there.
Yeah, well, I'll assume them.
Jupiter gets about 4% of the sunlight as the Earth does, so not very much. And
quite dim.
No sunlight's going to get through that, 3 kilometers at its thin spots, 10 to 20 kilometers at the thick spots. So it's not getting any sunlight down there. So basically you have a dark ocean underneath the ice of Europa. But there's also probably, we know it's warm, we know it's liquid, and, you know, the interior of the moon is constantly being stretched and pulled by the tidal forces of Jupiter, so it's warm, and there's probably volcanoes on the sea floor, you know, of that under ice, dark ocean under Europa. And so the question is, could there be life down there?
Well, I mean, right? all the ingredients are there. That's what I would say with that. Everything's there that should be needed.
Well, but is there? But is there? That's the question.
Yes.
So what are they missing?
Yes.
They're proteins. Missing oxygen.
Yeah, you're going to say oxygen, but that's... I don't... I'm not sure what... Go ahead.
Yeah, but
state your argument.
But...
Well, I'll just say this. There was life on Earth before there was oxygen, so how did we do it?
With photosynthesis, that's how.
We had obligate anaerobes that oxygen was poison. Oxygen will kill you. Kill you.
Yeah, so because the sun is a deadly laser, not anymore, there's a blanket. Did you guys ever see that? History of the Whole Universe?
Yeah, I saw that.
Very funny. All right.
I like your rendition.
Thank you. So on Earth, before there was oxygen, there was photosynthetic organisms that made oxygen out of sunlight, right? Carbon dioxide plus water plus sunlight equals sugar plus oxygen, right?
But wait, weren't there oxygenless anaerobes before photosynthesis?
So, well, you need light or oxygen, right? Take your pick.
One or the other. All right. Okay, so that's the rub. You need one or the other.
Yeah, and when we're talking about like underneath the ocean.
Europa has neither. Now, okay. Bob, I thought you were going to say, but what about chemosynthesis, right? They have.
So, Steve, this is all about chemosynthetic organisms.
What is the chemosynthesis reaction?
So, yeah, I saw your blog. I read the damn equation. there's oxygen in there.
But, exactly. It's carbon dioxide plus hydrogen sulfide plus oxygen yields sugar plus sulfur plus water. So, again, you need oxygen. So, even with chemosynthesis, you need oxygen. So, there's no oxygen or sunlight in the ocean under Europa. So what's happening? All right, so there's two possibilities, right, for life under Europa, and we don't know which, if anything, is going on down there. It could be sterile for all we know.
Yep.
But there's two possibilities if there is life. One is that it's life that figured out some other chemical reaction that doesn't require oxygen, that where it can either make oxygen or make energy without it. Now, I don't know if you guys recall this, but a couple of years ago, I think we talked about this, where biologists looking at archaea deep in the dark ocean found that when this one very common archaea, like it was 25% or so, whatever, 20% of the organisms that down there was oxygen, needed oxygen, to survive. And they thought, well, it was just dormant whenever it was too low below the level of where there's oxygen. And what they found was that, no, they're still little active little buggers down there. They're actually found a way to make their own oxygen. They only made a little bit of it, but it was a little bit more than what they needed to then use oxygen to make their sugars. And so they actually would also make a little bit of extra oxygen for the environment, because they said even when the lights are, when there's zero light, there was still oxygen that they could detect in the water. So something like that may be going on in Europa, where some little bacteria-like organism figured out a chemical pathway by which it could make energy, either it could make oxygen or where it could make energy without oxygen. The other possibility is that somehow oxygen is getting down into that water.
Right. That was an interesting idea.
Yeah. That is the subject of a new study. It's mainly a simulation, and they're trying to get ready for the Clipper mission, the Europa Clipper mission.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, which is taking off in 2024. We'll be getting to Europa sometime around 2030.
Eight damn years. Jesus.
I know. Why can't it be closer?
It's going to be in an orbit around Jupiter, but the orbit will take it past Europa multiple times. And it's got a bunch of instruments by which it can examine the surface of Europa. Radar to sort of peer beneath the ice, and a spectrograph to see what compounds are in the ice. So anyway, they're trying to, design the experiments they're going to be doing. And this was part of that. So, they're running simulations about what could be happening in the ice of Europa. So what they found was that radiation, ionized radiation, hitting the ice surface of Europa would split the water in the ice into hydrogen and oxygen, right?
Which it does. That's a deadly – do not hang out on Europa. That's a deadly surface.
Yep. That's the deadly laser again, but there's no blanket to protect you. So, so there's radiation ionizing the ice and turning it into hydrogen and oxygen. So what they wanted to find out was, so there's actually a substantial amount of oxygen kind of like dissolving in these little microbubbles in the surface ice of Europa. And their question was, is there a way that those bubbles of oxygen could get down into the ocean? And they found that the answer is...
Maybe.
Maybe it could.
Thanks.
Or we could have gone with, we don't know.
What research you have?
So there's looking at the thinner parts, you know, the chaos regions of Europa. If you look surface of Europa, these sections of it have a really complicated surface geometry. And those are the so-called chaos regions. And there the ice is thin, like 2 to 3 kilometers, as opposed to like the 15 to 20 kilometers at the thicker parts. So there's probably this briny, slushy, warmer water getting closer to the surface there. And in those sections, it's possible that you could have what they call these porous waves. So like the bubbles are in like these porous sections of ice, and those porous sections could actually move down through the ice, carrying these little bubbles of oxygen with them. Now, it would take thousands of years.
We got time.
It's been around for billions of years.
Doesn't matter, right? Yeah, as long as it would be like a conveyor belt of oxygen from the surface down into the ocean and delivering quite a substantial amount of oxygen into the ocean waters beneath Europa. If that's the case, then chemosynthetic organisms are off to the races, right? Then there's no problem. That dramatically would increase the prospects for life in the oceans under Europa. So that's perhaps one of the things that they'll be examining when the Europa Clipper mission gets to Europa, is the plausibility of this model that they came up with. Is, you know, they're trying to model what would happen on the surface of Europa.
That's
pretty cool. Yeah, it's pretty cool. So I didn't really appreciate how dim the prospects of life were in Europa without some new chemistry or new process going on that we don't know about.
I didn't know either. I'm very, disappointed. I was hopeful. Now I'm a little bit less hopeful, because now if this really cool thing happens, then we're good. But like we have, when they get there, they might be like, oh crap, this isn't happening. The oxygen is leaping off Europa. Now, Steve, what about Enceladus?
Yeah, they didn't. There was no mention of Enceladus.
Same idea though. Similar idea.
I guess. Right. It would be possible.
Oh man.
But yeah, the same factors apply.
Yeah. Right.
For Enceladus.
But is there the radiation? But it's the Jupiter, though, that's
really... It's Jupiter emanating radiation, I'm sure it is.
Right, because of Jupiter's magnetic field. So I don't know. What different the condition would be on Enceladus. It might be that there's no pathway for oxygen. But I think that the possibility of like this archaea that could make its own oxygen, that's really interesting.
Oh yeah, archaeas. That's the old. They're basically bacteria, but they're like the really old bacteria. So they've got metabolisms that are so off the wall and ancient, and it's amazing. They're totally amazing. Like for example, Radio Durans is one of my favorite. You blow apart, blow apart the DNA, and it's like, and it just gets back together, I'm going to get back together.
It's a flesh wound.
It's a flesh wound.
Now, when people say extremophiles, are we talking the same thing, or is that different?
That's in the ballpark.
I mean, they probably are extremophiles.
That applies to both bacteria and archaea, I would say.
Extremophiles are just organisms that live in parts of the planet that most things wouldn't survive.
Right.
Yeah, it's either...
The broader category.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, extremes of temperature, extremes of salinity.
Salinity, yep, that's
or
big.
Pressure.
Or extremes of pressure or extremes of radiation.
Yeah.
Any of those could qualify you as an extremophile.
And then like underneath that, you'll have like thermophiles. So those are the ones in extreme temperature.
Steve, can we use these, this bacteria for anything useful? The ones that are producing their own oxygen? I don't know. I mean, right now it's just a research curiosity.
I mean, we can embed them in our lungs in case, you're oxygen deprived.
We can breathe.
I guess it depends on like what they eat and like, could you harvest oxygen from them?
Yeah, but I think they'd give you a terrible gas, Jay.
Yes. Well,
no, but like, what if they took them to Mars and had a tank filled with them that, and, you know, just churning out oxygen?
I guess.
But I think they can. You can get oxygen readily, though.
Yeah, but because you have sunlight on Mars, so you could make it with sunlight. If you have sunlight, right, then oxygen is not a problem.
Blue skies on Mars.
So this, you know, I called this dark life. I don't know if anyone else used that term, but so we may need to discover the chemistry and life cycle of dark life. Like, what would a completely dark ecosystem be like? You know, that's what we're talking about.
That also decreases the chance of life on rogue planets, right? That's disappointing as hell, too. God damn it.
Yeah. The lack of photosynthesis is significant.
Yeah.
It wouldn't surprise me if just that completely different life cycles evolve, you know, without
different
light.
Metabolisms.
Yeah.
You know.
Or what? Maybe they could use the radiation as a source instead of the sunlight.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's definitely a good science fiction novel there. Somewhere.
I mean, oxygen's great for complicated life because there's a lot of – it's potent, right? But you don't necessarily –
the high-energy molecule.
Yeah, you don't need it. I mean, there's other types of metabolisms like based on fermentation, for example. But apparently, you know, you need even a little bit of oxygen even for that is my takeaway here, which is, you know, annoying.
No, but I think I see your confusion there. So fermentation by definition is metabolizing carbohydrates in the absence of oxygen. So that there, you can have anaerobes that eat sugar, basically, that eat carbohydrates, but those carbohydrates have to be made by another organism. So once you have oxygen or photosynthesis and you're producing food, essentially, then you can have the evolution of organisms that eat the food, and they can be anaerobic. That's fine. But if the origin of the carbohydrates, the energy storing molecules, needs to come from either photosynthesis or oxygen, as far as we know, again, unless there's some other process out there.
I mean, I'd be fine with just pure, you know, kind of boring single cell life on Europa or Enceladus. I'd be happy with that.
That'd be super cool.
Oh my gosh.
The problem is we'd have to hit it while it's alive and recognize it. Because it's unlikely that there would be fossilized evidence of that.
Right.
If it's just single cells, yeah. Unless it's in mats or something. Yeah,
unless it, exactly.
Or it spells that, words for us. Knows.
The big issue is going to be making sure there's no contamination. Like, how are we going to water without contaminating
it? Hey, look.
Yes. Yeah, but
DNA.
Hey, look, it's covered in staff.
Yeah, but if you find proteins that don't exist on Earth, like, okay, that's no contamination.
Yeah,
that's
like if you find stuff that has a different chirality, like there are some real signatures that would tell you this is alien.
All right, Kara, tell us about ancient skull surgery.
Ooh.
Okay, so.
No, thanks.
Oh, my God.
I'll go for the modern version. Thank you very much.
Do you know that I actually – so I'm going to talk a little bit about trepanation. You guys know about trepining, right?
Yeah, like, it hurts, man.
Cutting
it
holes
hurts.
In skulls. I actually have – this is the weirdness that is Cara Santa Maria. A very dear friend once for Christmas got me a trepanation drill bit.
Cool.
I know.
A little blood on it.
Like from how
a little
from what decade? You know,
it's not ancient. It's probably from like 100 years ago.
Yeah.
So it was like used in medicine, but like the type of medicine you would not want to undergo.
Quotes medicine.
We know that trepanation is an old practice, and actually, I didn't even realize this, but there's evidence in Morocco of trepanation from 13,000 years ago.
What?
Yeah, and that seems to be the oldest potential evidence. But there's a lot of evidence from like 1,000 years ago. We've also seen ancient Egypt, so other kind of northern African areas around 4,000 years ago. But in North America, there's sort of been a dearth of evidence, and most of it has only been within the past millennium. Yet, a researcher, a bioarchaeologist named Diana Simpson, who works at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, recently presented her investigation at the American Association of Biological Anthropologists annual meeting, which was about a week ago as of this recording, called Surgery Before Sedentism, Probable Trepanation During the Early Prehistoric Period in Southeastern North America. So this was a region of present-day Alabama where actually...
Go Bama!
Yeah, where actually, sadly, these remains were basically grave dug in the 1940s. It's a site called the Little Bear Creek site, a burial mound that's covered in seashells. The man, the kind of specimen in question, as well as 162 others were excavated at that time and kind of sent to different museums and things like that. And so these specimens have been studied by paleoanthropologists for a while. And this researcher was looking at an interesting wound on the head of this specific man, kind of in the frontal bone, and realized that it had markings that were very likely caused by some sort of tool. So they look like scrapings. The researcher believes that these scrapings are indicative of tool use and not created naturally by the injury itself or by an animal or anything like that. And then, of course, the hallmark of trepanation, which we've probably read about before, is what?
Healing.
Yeah, healing. So there's evidence that the bone continued to heal for possibly up to a year after the skull surgery. And the interesting thing about this specific man was that he was very likely an important person within the culture. So his burial was pretty atypical. There was, as she words it, an extensive mortuary assemblage. It seems of the era that he was most likely a shaman or potentially a shaman who does tattoos, because they found some really cool turkey bones that at other anthropological sites were thought to be basically like crude tattoo guns. So they looked similar to other sites where they've recovered these turkey bones, sometimes deer bones, that are pointed on one end. And there was, not at this site, but at other sites, again, there was evidence of pigment at the tips of them, and then sometimes shells that were full of pigment as well. So they were almost like pots for whatever was being used as the ink. So these very, very kind of early crude tattoos. But the interesting thing about this specific example here in North America is that it's by far the oldest, and it's the only example that we have of hunter-gatherer individuals utilizing trepanation. Every other example we have is from sedentary groups that had already settled in certain regions and weren't moving. But this group was a hunter-gatherer group that was known to be kind of nomadic in nature. Mm. And that's an interesting idea that trepanation would have somehow either been spontaneously utilized or that knowledge and wisdom would have been passed to these individuals. Because this is the earliest case that we know now here in North America.
Yeah, and it's possible that it was not just a ritual, that it was actually medical procedure.
Yeah, it's actually probably likely that it was medical, because this individual also had broken bones and a wound above their eye socket, I think. Yeah. And so they think either, you know, he was attacked or he fell down. He had some sort of traumatic injury and very likely was had maybe brain swelling, or maybe there was a piece of skull that was invading his brain that needed to be removed. So they saw this as a means to potentially save this man's life, as opposed to many of the examples, yes, that we know about trepanation, which are kind of like letting out evil spirits, like psychiatric surgery, things of that nature.
Right.
But I love this stuff. I love like old brain surgery stuff. Yeah. It's fascinating that people actually lived.
Yeah, they would survive for years after.
For years sometimes, yeah. I cannot imagine that initial period after the surgery, or during the surgery, I should say, but definitely during and immediately after, was a particularly pleasurable time for these individuals.
How did they survive the infection?
Exactly.
The infection would be
I don't get it.
Yeah, that's the killer. I mean, that's and even with examples of this, it is usually the killer. Like, even when we think back to Phineas Gage, the very like famous example of a frontal lobe injury from the railroad tamping iron that went kind of through his cheek and out his frontal lobe. He ultimately lived. He lived for quite a long time, but I do think he ultimately succumbed to infection years later.
Yeah, I didn't know that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he lived for long enough for people to see his personality change and, you know, draw a lot of really interesting conclusions about what the frontal lobe does. But yeah, I think he did ultimately succumb even years later.
He had
but,
seizures as well. He had bad seizures.
Right. Yeah, he did. Right. And so, yeah, there's, you know, infection is pernicious, and it can lay dormant. It can come back again and again. And especially when you got a hole in your head, you know, unless now what we would do is we would put a plate, or we would, you know, have some sort of means to close that up. But back in the day, I don't know how they covered it. They might have put like a leaf on their head or something.
It's not as big a deal as you think, though. I mean, having a piece of your skull removed as long as the skin is closed over it, yeah, if you could, it would
scar. But they wouldn't have had sutures. So the hope is that...
It's not that big a deal, actually.
Yeah. I mean, the hope is that there was a skin flap to heal. Yeah. You know what I mean? That they weren't suturing it. And then that that you sort of are careful.
Yeah.
Right? You just got to be careful around that area. But I think for this dude, it was like on his forehead. So it's pretty exposed.
All right, Jay, I understand that the Artemis 1 mission is stuck.
I mean, that's a little dramatic. I mean, of course, NASA was going to run into some snags as they, you know, they slowly brought that monstrosity out onto the launch pad at Kennedy Space Center. So this happens on Monday, April 4th. NASA began fueling the Artemis 1 rocket, and they had to stop due to a yet another technical issue. So this is the second time they had to pause testing. The first time NASA tried to fuel the Artemis 1 rocket was on Sunday, April 3rd. And they stopped before pumping propellant began because there was an issue with pressurization fans on the mobile launcher. So to be more clear about that, those fans keep hazardous gases out of areas where technicians work, in those areas that are enclosed. So it was a safety issue. And I guess they resolved that issue on Sunday. So on Monday the 4th, they tried again to pump about 700,000 gallons or 2.6 million liters of super cold cryogenic fuel to the rocket.
Wow.
The technical issue this time was a stuck vent valve found on.
It was stuck.
It was stuck. Yes, it was. But they could unstick it. This was found on the mobile launcher, and this valve is about 160 feet or 49 meters up in the air. And the valve is used to vent pressure from the rocket's core stage as they add fuel. So if you picture the fuel tank that's inside of the core rocket. That fuel tank is huge, right? And they have to fill it with the propellant, which is it could be hydrogen, it could be oxygen, just depends on, you know, what that particular rocket needs. So they're filling it up, and there's a valve at the top of the tank that is used to regulate the overall pressure inside of the tank. And it's very, very specific and very tricky. That pressure has to be maintained at a very specific pressure. And if it goes out of bounds, then bad things can happen. So they figured out that valve wasn't working, and they immediately started to drain the fuel out of the tanks. And they said the rocket was about half full when NASA had to remove
or all half empty.
Yes, depends. Well, does it depend on which way you're going? I don't know. right. In this case, what's unbelievable, guys? On very trusted websites, I'm reading oxygen and I'm reading hydrogen, and I don't know.
It's both. It's got to be both, Jay, because they burn one with the other.
I totally agree, but Steve, it wasn't clear. That's all I'm trying to point out, is even on like space.com and websites where you think they'd give you a very nice clear picture, it wasn't that clear.
Well, probably because it is both. I mean, eventually there's got to have both in there. If it's liquid, if that's the fuel, I mean, the fuel could be oxygen and something else, you know, but if it's hydrogen oxygen, which is the best because it's got the best specific impulse, then yeah, you have liquid oxygen, you have the hydrogen, they burn them together, and it's the fuel and propellant, because that's also what gets shot out the bottom of the rocket.
Right. So as we record this right now on Tuesday the 5th, we don't know if NASA is going to try one more time today. It's very likely, I think, that they'll try tomorrow, which will be Wednesday. And by the time you're hearing this, it could be, you know, days or almost a week later. But, you know, the takeaway here is that we have an amazingly complicated system that they built. So many things could go wrong. And the fact is, they haven't run into that many snags at all. This is exactly the type of things that they're trying to find ahead of time before they schedule the full launch. This is really cool. So what they're doing during these tests is they will start the real countdown clock 38 hours. Like, that's about how long the countdown clock has to run for to go through all of the pre-checks and steps and everything, right? When they test launch the SLS on the launch pad, they run through the countdown all the way down to T-minus 90 seconds, right, from 38 hours. Yeah. Then they'll do this several times until they're satisfied with all the various systems and that they all check out. Then they'll say, okay, we got that part of it down. Then we'll take the countdown now to let's go to the 10-minute mark and run through, like, the last 10 minutes and go through those systems over and over and over and over again. All the way up until just before engine ignition. And there is a transfer of control from the command center to the actual Orion module. At some point in the very last few seconds, I guess they transfer control over to that system, and they're testing that out as well. So knowing that that's one of the very last things to take place, they need to make sure that all these systems are working exactly the way that they need to in order for this launch to be safe. And another thing that is significant but completely out of the hands of humans is there's other factors like whether there's lightning within a certain number of miles. Mm-hmm. I think it's 5 miles. There can only be – it has to be less than a 20% chance of lightning within a 5-mile radius of the launch pad. The winds have to be less than 37.5 knots, and the temperature must be above 41 degrees. And there's a lot of things like this going on, like a lot of things that factor in that must-haves in order for them to launch. And you know when they're checking in, you know when you hear in it, when they're at the command center and they're talking and you're like, blah, 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 check in. The guy's like, yep, blah, 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 check in. The girl goes, oh, yep, we're all set. You're like,
all the stations, yeah.
Yeah, they're checking in with all of like the subsystems, the people mm-hmm. that are in charge of all the subsystems that can see like a heads-up display of what's going on. Is their portion of this puzzle functioning?
Yeah, it's like a set of eyes specifically on each component of the entire mechanism going on. There's tons of things to check.
But you could imagine that there's people that are beyond them, like that are even in a more subdivided subsystem that's telling them it's okay. So it goes up the chain, right? You know, you got a lot of people eyes on. It's not just the people that are in the command center that are giving thumbs up. It's like lots of people on the ground and all over the place.
Yeah, imagine the thumbs up are coming from that team's leader. And there's a team of people below each of those people.
Right.
Makes sense.
So overall, you know, even though there was, you know, you wouldn't even call them setbacks. They just had issues that came up during these tests as predicted. Everything seems to be in fantastic shape. They're still saying that they are thumbs up for a June launch, and it's going to be late June. It's going to be late. I know, but it's coming, guys. They're going to light that sucker up, and we're going to see Artemis 1 take off. It's going to be glorious, man. It's going to be one of those things. Like, you just don't get to see it that often.
That would be worth a trip going there and seeing that. Definitely.
I totally would do Artemis 2 in a heartbeat.
You want to go?
I would do it. Yeah.
Think we can go?
I would
love
to.
Where is it launching from?
Well, this one, Artemis 1, is going to launch from Kennedy Space Center.
Okay.
Oh, my gosh.
But you need to get – I mean, I saw the last shuttle launch, and it was awesome. Don't get me wrong. It was great. But you're so far away.
Yeah, but it's more about – Bob, you were there. It's more about the camaraderie and the vibe that's in the air. You know, it's just an exciting, you know, place to be and to watch the rocket. You're basically as close as you can get. Unless you have inside passes and things like that, right?
Yeah, VIP, baby.
When right? I was – but Bob, when I saw the Soyuz launch in Kazakhstan?
Yeah,
from Baikonur. We were relatively close, and it was like – it kind of hurts.
Ooh,
like, you don't want to be too
wave?
Close.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, it's a little painful. What was
you had to be like 5 miles from the Apollo when it took off, like miles away.
And I feel like we were only like – I could be wrong, but I feel like we were only like a mile from the launch pad or something.
Yeah. No, if you were close, you would literally die. It would kill you.
So does that mean they find a lot of dead birds in a 5-mile radius of these things?
You know, absolutely.
So animals die as a result of this, huh?
Yeah.
Because the animals don't
know it's coming. It bursts your lungs. Yeah, just the pressure wave is so intense that it would kill you.
Oh, wow.
They put signs up for the birds, though, to stay away.
I think – when I visited there, I did watch like a smaller rocket launch. I mean, I have a vague memory. We'd have to look it up. I think they do like – try to chase them away right before the launch somehow.
Scare them with sounds.
Yeah, they might do the little –
They're called shooers. There's a bunch of people that just run around and yell shoo out.
They all have umbrellas and they open and close them real fast and run around.
But let it sink in, guys. You know, this is history being made. This is the largest rocket, the heaviest lift rocket ever to launch. This thing is going to be louder than anything else that's ever happened out there. It is ushering in. You know, I don't want to minimize anything that SpaceX has done. And believe me, you know, SpaceX has accomplished quite a bit. And it has helped the industry a lot. But this is the heavy lift rocket that we've been hearing about for a very long time. And it's happening in about a month and a half. We're going to see some magical thing happen. And
oh my gosh.
I highly recommend that you take that moment out of wherever you are that day and watch it. You know, why not? You want to be able to tell people, hey, I saw that rocket lift off. And Artemis too. I mean, when people are being sent back to the moon and then, you know, this is the beginning of a permanent moon base, that's the big one. As far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
So Kennedy has several bird deterrent methods that they use.
Oh, you looked it up. yes, go.
Like firing off large cannons.
Uh-huh.
And they also have people shooting blanks at individual birds. Because it's not wow. just that they don't want the birds to die. They don't want the birds to be in the way. You know, they yeah. don't want a bird hitting, ooh. You know, part of the rocket or the space shuttle, whatever, as it's launching. So, yeah, they were very fastidious about clearing the area of birds.
That makes so much sense. I mean, you know, a piece of foam.
Yeah, right.
You know, just hit. Yeah, it fell off and
foam, you know,
did them in.
Now, of course, you know, when the rocket comes off the launch pad, it's not moving that fast. But still, you don't want a bird or an animal to get in the way or get into a mechanism or whatever. Like, it's got to be, they've got to be very fastidious.
Oh, yeah. Aren't birds, and I mean, I know this is different because I'm talking about general aviation, but isn't bird strike like a reason for a lot of bad things happening with airports?
Yeah, airports. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. They have bird deterrent systems, definitely.
Yeah, like it can take down a whole plane if a bird like goes through the engine or something.
All right, Bob, tell us about the most distant star ever.
Yeah, so NASA tantalized us recently with the announcement on March 28th of a major announcement to come 2 days later. You know,
they're good like that. Wait a minute.
Yeah.
They can't do that. That's not fair.
As Steve said, we learned that Hubble had discovered a record-breaking star that was the most distant star ever discovered.
Hubble's still paying dividends. That is amazing.
Oh, yeah, I know. But I don't know about you guys, but whenever NASA makes an announcement about a big damn announcement, it just sets me up for disappointment. Right? In my mind, I go right towards
dark
evidence of alien life, a stable wormhole, or maybe an alien ship in orbit around Jupiter or something. So then when they come back with the news a few days later, the discovery, it's like, whatever it is, doesn't matter. It's a huge, huge letdown. And I'm just like just pissed off in my head. And just stop it, NASA, and make one announcement, please.
You watch too many movies, Bob.
Yeah, okay, wait. I'm done.
Right?
But think about this. They could be announcing that we're about to get wiped out by an asteroid, so that's something.
Yeah, that's something to look forward to. Yeah,
that would meet your expectations, right, Bob?
So, but despite all that, this is cool, though. And NASA said the following. This is their quote. NASA's Hubble Space Telescope has established an extraordinary new benchmark, detecting the light of a star that existed within the first billion years after the universe's birth in the Big Bang, the farthest individual star ever seen to date. So that's really cool. That's worth celebrating. You know, maybe you don't need to make an announcement about it, but, you know, it's still really good. So
wait, the farthest star also means the oldest star or no? Okay, that's what I thought.
Well, no.
Wait, what do you mean no?
No.
Someone else lied to me years
ago? No, I'll say that there could be stars that were created after this that were smaller and therefore much longer lived than this one, which was a big one. But this one
is the farthest and the oldest?
The farthest. This is the farthest one individual star that we've ever seen. So,
but we've seen older stars.
There are older ones, that have lived longer than this.
You guys are talking about two different things.
Right.
Yeah, that's what
Sarah's talking about, that this star, as we are seeing it, was the farthest back in time, and that is correct. Okay. Bob's talking about long-lived stars. So
right, that's not what I'm asking you, Bob. No. I'm asking you, as we're seeing this star, it is the farthest away physically, which also means it is the oldest
back
that
in
we
time.
Have ever observed.
The oldest light. The oldest light. I'll say that. Okay, so this was accomplished by scientists working on Hubble's reionization lensing cluster survey. Program called RELICS, which is a really cool acronym. So, okay, so here are the stats. The star is named Arendelle, which is just wonderful since it's not a stupid number designation.
Is that from Lord of the Rings?
It's beautiful. It's a beautiful name, and it sounds like elves live on it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Arendelle. It's like,
it does.
Right out of Tolkien. The name means rising light or morning star. So it formed about 900 million years after the Big Bang, when the universe was just 7% of its current age. A long time ago, the photons that we see now took 12.9 billion light years to reach us, which is so funny because
about
from
time.
The photons' point of view, at the speed of light, they think, whoa, we were just created and now we're absorbed by Hubble? What the hell? So yeah, for them, not such a long time. For us, crazy long time. Silly photons. Okay, so here's another cool, interesting perspective. When this light left the star, it was 4 billion light years away from the baby proto-Milky Way at that time, whatever the hell shape we were in. 4 billion light years away. But due to the expansion of space, though, it took 13 billion years to get here, and its origin point is now 28 billion light years away. So, universal expansion. I mean, that's just, it's so cool. It's traveling all this time, and but the universe is expanding very, very fast as well. So it really messes with the numbers. So there's not a lot, there's not a hell of a lot we know about the star yet. We do know that it's millions of times brighter than the sun, and at least 50 to 500 solar masses. So it's a lot of star going on there. That's a lot. That's big, big, big. But if you want specifics about its mass or temperature or even the type of star, we're going to have to wait. And of course, it's almost certainly pretty much dead now because this was a good, because it's a good sized star, it has a lot of fuel, but that doesn't translate into a long life because it reaches such amazingly high temperatures that they last on the order of hundreds of millions of years, whereas our sun, for example, is billions, and even lower mass stars are even much more than that. So it's definitely a dead husk somewhere. So the story though, the part of the story that I think is most intriguing though is the detection itself, and this is it's fascinating. First off, total chance. This is a total like throwing a die with a million sides to it, and like oh boy, this is a nice coincidence. They were very, very lucky. So this is what happened. They were studying a relatively nearby galaxy cluster. And they noticed that the cluster was acting as a gravitational lens, right? You get enough mass together, you're going to get a gravity so intense that it's actually bending light and acting like a lens. So you got this gravitational lens going on, and it's magnifying and distorting the light from a far more distant galaxy behind it, behind the cluster. Oh, look, here's another galaxy, really, really far away. And the gravitational lens smeared that light from the galaxy into a long crescent shape. And they call that crescent shape a sunrise arc, which is kind of pretty.
So, Bob, it was a galaxy far, far away?
Yes.
A long time
and
ago.
And yes.
I see what you did there, Steve.
Bob's puppet voice.
So you got this smeared image of a galaxy that's really far away. That's not a big deal. Oh, you know, here's a smeared image of an early galaxy. Even this galaxy, the distance that this galaxy was, that's not a big deal. That's happened before. They found these smeared out, very, very distant, very, very old galaxies before. They've done that. Not a big deal. But what was especially fortuitous here was that a single star was greatly magnified, kind of pulled out of this smear, this galaxy smear. Oh, look, here's one little star that's in that galaxy that just happens to be super, super clear and just pops right out. And that, of course, was Arendelle. I wanted to go into more detail, though. Like, why? Why did this star pop out? Because this is just a smear of light. Well, these galaxies, they never see the stars. They just see a smear of light, which is like all of the stars. So why did this one tiny... why did this star pop out of that smear? So I found this quote from NASA that explained it, and I never heard this before. So the star Arendelle appears directly on or extremely close to a ripple in the fabric of space.
Ooh. What?
This ripple, I'm not sure exactly. Like, it's on a ripple. Like, wait a second.
Is ripple a technical term?
So let me finish the quote. So they say, okay. this ripple, which is defined in optics as a caustic, provides maximum magnification and brightening. So, okay, I kind of get the idea, but this still, like, what exactly are you talking about? So then they offered a really good analogy. And what they do is they compare it to the rippling waves on a pool, right? We've all looked at a pool that's rippling a little bit, and you look and these ripples cause these dancing light patterns on the bottom of the pool, right? We've all seen it's completely random and chaotic, but there you see these patterns of bright and dark spots. And that's exactly what this is. You've got these ripples in space that this star is just positioned just so perfectly that somehow it's magnified like the light is on the rippling pool. And it was magnified many, many thousands of times, even more than the galaxy itself. It was extra, extra magnified because of this fortuitous placement of the star. And bam, that's how Arendelle popped out from the galaxy. Which is really cool. And it's rare. I'm not sure, you know, how much that's happened in the past, but it's also very interesting that this high resolution image of the star could last for years. It's not something that's so fleeting that it only lasts a week or a month. This could last for multiple years, which is good because then we could study it even more.
Wait, Bob.
Yeah.
I gotta get back to the ripples.
Yeah.
Are these these ripples in space, are they gravitational? What's causing space to ripple?
Well, I mean, it's got to be related to the gravitational lensing effect. So let me look at the quote again.
Okay.
It appears directly. it appears that the star Arendelle appears directly on or extremely close to a ripple in the fabric of space. So
yeah, like if space is rippling, like condensing or expanding, like physically, rippling, it must be gravitational, right?
Unless
right.
It's really it's all muscular.
It's
going to bomb right. you up.
It's rippling. That's actually a quote from a Bruce Lee movie, Return of the Dragon. Very nice, yeah. Steve. Very nice. Very nice. I like that. So it's definitely related to the gravitational lensing effect. And I guess it was an especially potent section of the lensing effect that gave it an extra magnification. That's what it's got to be. I can't think of anything else. So really cool. So here's a quote from Brian Welch, who was a lead author and astronomer. He said, studying Arendelle will be a window into an era of the universe that we are unfamiliar with, but that led to everything we do know. It's like we've been reading a really interesting book, but we started with the second chapter, and now we'll have a chance to see how it all got started. So that's cool, because this star is a very early star, and it's very different from the stars that are around now. So, all right, so what about the future? Following up observations of Arendelle, James Webb is basically going to take over for the Hubble, and it's going to analyze the star's infrared light. And Webb has obviously much better optics than Hubble, especially in its specific wavelengths. And it should be able to confirm, that this is a star and it's a single star, because it could potentially possibly be a binary, which they think is not impossible at all. It very well could be a binary or a single star. So James Webb could distinguish that, and it'll be able to measure the star's chemical composition, which would be very revealing because, like I said, the universe back then, it wasn't filled with many metals back then. So stars did not have much metal in them, which greatly changes the star itself. It's very important, and that's why we classify stars in population 1, population 2, etc. So that can be revealed as well by James Webb, and James Webb I think may even break this final record by Hubble, probably the last biggest record breaking discovery that Hubble makes. But James Webb could potentially go even farther. But I'm thinking, well, really? I mean, this sounds like a very, very rare situation where you've got this smeared galaxy in a gravitational lens where one star just happens to be placed so perfectly. I don't know how that sounds pretty uncommon to me. Maybe this won't be repeated for a really long time, or maybe James Webb will just find one in the first few weeks. I don't know. But keep an eye out for this. This is really interesting and interesting story to research. Very, very, very cool.
Yeah, it is cool. And NASA. Evan, your Lord of the Rings instincts are very good. So this is Arendelle, E-A-R-E-N-D-E-L, which is Old English for morning star. Arendelle, with an I-L at the end, otherwise the same spelling, is a half-elven mariner who voyaged to Valinor. He was also the father of Elrond and also Elros, the king of Numenor. So,
my God.
Very, very similar. Wait. Are you reacting to what Steve is saying or the fact that Steve is saying it?
Yeah.
It's like, yes. Wow. It goes so deep.
12.9 billion deep.
Kara.
Evan, tell us about fake news.
Fake news. We've all heard of fake news. Well, Madison Daspovich, she wrote a piece published at Business Insider about how she, as a Snopes fact checker, is able to detect fake news. And, of course, she suggests, and it's something we've been saying forever on this podcast, that many things in life are kind of complicated and they fall on a spectrum. They're not all black and white. They're not binary. This is the fogginess of truth detection, but some nefarious people, in some cases under-informed people, will use those gray areas or incomplete sets of knowledge and data to take advantage of other groups of people and consumers of news or to push agendas, promote their biases, and sometimes outright deceive. So she writes, rarely do we see a post that's purely true or false, and more often than not, we come across claims or rumors that lack important nuance. Yes, where have we heard that before or talked about that before? Human nature wants answers and explanations, but bad actors take advantage of that to spread the falsehoods online and inciting emotions and further polarizing groups of opposing ideologies. Absolutely. And she brought up the Russia-Ukraine conflict sort of as the example in this particular article about how this is prevalent, especially with, right now it's the most prevalent or one of the most prevalent events taking place right now in the world. Here are a couple of the examples of things she has had to investigate about claims about the Russia-Ukraine conflict. All right, claim. A video shows Ukrainian soldiers killing civilians in Chechnya. So in March 2022, a video was circulated on social media in an apparent attempt to justify Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and it supposedly showed Ukrainian soldiers ruthlessly killing civilians in Chechnya. Okay, so she did the digging into it, and guess what? That's wrong.
It was fake?
It was a scene from a movie.
I love
yeah.
that.
Yeah, right. And furthermore, the movie soldiers in the film are playing Russians, not Ukrainians. And the Russians are killing the Chechens at the start of the Second Chechen War. So that's just one example. Here's another example. Video shows Ukrainian tank crash through Russian barrier in 2022. No, miscaption. Video dates back to 2014. So basically, you have these old things that are being recirculated and repurposed and just being thrown out there as news coming out of the current conflict. But in fact, with a little investigation, you find out they're absolutely bunk. Did you hear about this one? Ukrainian army cats trained to spot sniper lasers.
Oh,
you
know, no way.
Cats and lasers. You know, cats and lasers, that whole thing, how they, you know, go after the laser. So here's the claim. In February 2022, a photograph started circulating on social media that supposedly showed a Ukrainian army cat named Mikhail, who had been dubbed the Panther of Kharkiv, after it was trained to detect the lasers of enemy snipers. And while they're not certain of the photo's exact origins, it's been online actually since at least 2018, and it was posted by a Twitter account called UK Army Cats and Dogs. So, yeah. You know, these are just a couple of the examples that they cite. So, and she gives some, you know, good tips for people to, when they read about these things, especially with current events, how can you detect, you know, what you're reading is real and what you're reading is probably not real. She talks about being able to, well, identify coordinated inauthentic behavior. And that refers to the use of multiple social media accounts and pages to hide the real identities of those in charge to mislead or influence people. For example, you know, if in Facebook, you've got this section of a page called Page Transparency, and it allows the viewer to see the information about who is managing the page, what country it's originating from, and all the changes that have been made. So found within that page transparency section is data like the page creation date. You can also tell if it was something, you know, very recent or something that's been around a long time. You can tell if it sort of sprouted up as just a sudden means to get people to try to believe whatever story or whatever this particular page is putting out there, or if it has been established around for a while and so forth. You can look at the history of what this has been and where it has been. Another thing she brought up is something I had not heard of before. Kara, I think you have heard of this before, though.
What?
Copypasta?
Copypasta?
Have you heard that term before?
Oh, yeah, I have.
What is it?
Why did I not know this term before reading this particular article?
Evan, I just heard it for the first time a week ago. So
right. It's a portmanteau for copy and paste. Copypasta is the 21st century equivalent of
That's not a portmanteau of copy and paste.
No, it's not right.
That would be copy-aste.
Well, okay.
To paste. Copypasta is just a completely made up word.
You get the point.
It's sort of a portmanteau, but it's poetically tweaked because copypasta is funny.
Right.
It is funny, but it's not a portmanteau.
Do you guys remember chainmail and you know?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Boy, remember when you used to? Did you ever guys get ever those in the actual mail back in like the 1970s mm-hmm. when people would mail letters and saying chain letters? Okay, now you have to pass this letter around to ten more
what?
People.
They wasted stamps on that.
They did, Kara. That was a real thing. And
of course, stamps were pretty cheap back then, right?
But you know, it takes on a whole new meaning in the age of the internet, as opposed to using the postal system to spread this stuff. Plus, also, it gets a little tweaked. You know, it's like playing telephone. You know, you get little tweaks also along the way. So that thing has no, and often no recollection to what the original idea was, if you go 10 generations down the line, it may have totally, entirely changed if it was even legit to begin with. So you have to be able to spot that kind of stuff. Oh, yeah. Be on the lookout for troll bait. Obviously, we talk about trolling quite a bit. I think we all, you know what that is. But, you know, Steve, you know.
Don't get sea lions.
All right. And Steve, you know, there are people on the, you know, commenters who intentionally start arguments or, you know, to do a, you know, stoke the fires. And that's kind of all they do. Yeah, you have to be careful of those, you know. And it's not just comments; it's posts, it's pictures, graphs, total, you know, distortions. Always as a means, sort of, to drive a particular traffic, maybe in some way, but also to kind of get people very upset. You know, so these are kind of the basic tools, and of course, it's all stuff we've talked about, stuff we come across regularly, and try to inform our listenership about as well. But I'm glad someone who's actually on the inside at Snopes is also writing articles and further informing people about what to be on the lookout for.
Constantly. Like we just talked about that at the front of the show. It's only getting worse.
Worse.
And so this is part of media savvy, which is now part of skepticism. You have to be able to identify or at least have a process, you know, by which you evaluate these things and at least don't knee-jerk accept, you know, as real anything that you see like that. That's coming to you through social media. And sometimes even mainstream media, like, they get things wrong too.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
So yeah, just have that skeptical filter for everything. Absolutely.
Yep.
All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys, last week I played this noisy. Kind of has like a Logan's Run vibe to it, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Or Outer Limits.
All right, you get the idea. So what do you guys think this is?
Yeah, like at first it was wind chimes, but then it became digital.
Yeah, I agree.
Wait, I lost track. Was this a sonification or no?
It is.
It is, okay.
So I should say that. And just so you know, this is a sonification. I told you I would tell you when I do that. I don't play these that often because I think they're very hard to guess.
Data turned into sound.
Correct. So a listener named Adam Hepburn and his entire family guessed. He said, Joseph, I saw the Discord notification pop up on my phone. You know, he knew it came out early, so he had his daughters with him. So his daughter Olivia said, it's a creepy ladybug.
Aww.
His daughter Elise said, a creepy bug. And he said, I should have asked her first because she always says what her sister says. And then I think his wife is named Kristen, and she said, I just assume everything is a rain stick.
I constantly hear rain sticks, too. It's either a rain stick or a talking marine mammal.
Oh, gosh.
So then his guess was, because he knew this was a sonification, he said, a sonification of an fMRI signal of someone who died while hooked up.
Oh, God.
Wow.
Yeah, I thought that was really provocative. So you guys are not correct, although you win the family award, which I've never given before.
And just made up on the spot, but go ahead.
I did. I just made that up. Another listener named William Simpson wrote in and said, betcha that's the SARS-CoV-2. Now, I thought that was a cool guess as well because it fits in. I did say that we talk about this type of thing. Like, there was like a theme thematically here.
I also love how he said it. Betcha that's the SARS-CoV-2. Like,
yeah,
look it up on the Google.
We had another listener. That's not correct. It's not SARS-CoV-2. Another listener named Marcel Janssen said, hi, Jay, no idea, but since you stressed it was creepy and that fitted, it could well be some bug signal. So I say it's the sonified sound of the electric muscle signal of beetles or some other bug flying and starting to fly.
Aw, bugs aren't creepy.
Some of them are, definitely. Mm. Okay, that is not correct, but I think that's a fantastic guess. Another listener named Jim Kelly wrote in and said, hi, Jay, I'm guessing that this week's noisy is a sonification of the hairs on the body of a spider, perhaps a tarantula.
Getting closer.
Definitely getting closer. This is a fantastic guess, and there is something in there that is about the answer. So we did have a winner from last week, and that winner is Josh Weber. And Josh says, hey, everyone, I think this week's noisy is essentially the sounds of playing the strands of a spider web. I read an article this week that talked about sonification of spider webs. Based on the clue given, this seems to fit perfectly with creepy.
Hmm.
Yeah, so this is the sonification of a spider web where, you know, some type of visual scan is done and they mathematically like measure the length of the spider webs, and they're able to transpose those spider webs into sounds, and that's what you're hearing. And I thought that, Bob, you would particularly like this one.
I don't think they're transposing them. I think they're transducing them.
Well, there's lots of different ways to sonify something.
Okay.
So as an example, like a very common sonification you'll hear is they'll take a picture of space, and every time a star or a galaxy, you know, comes into view from a left to right scan of the picture, they'll play a note. But the bottom line is that this is what a spider web would sound like if it played music, I guess, right? If it was turned into sound. I think it's fascinating. You know, you think of all the complexity of spider webs. One listener wrote in and said, and I think it was Visto Tutti who said that this was definitely not a drunk spider, because if a spider is drunk, it'll make a crooked web.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's
see
funny.
The webs on the – it's spiders on acid and the webs they
those
make.
Those are cool.
Yeah, they are distorted for certain. All right, I have a new Noisy for you guys this week. This Noisy was sent in by a listener named Josh Nankivell, and here is the Noisy. Now, I don't know why I'm playing these creepy ones.
I know. Is that not just like a continuation of the last noise? So,
it is.
Spiderweb part two?
This one is not a sonification of any kind.
Oh.
I will give you no more hints. This one is.
It's a cobweb sound music.
It's the sound of the actual spider getting drunk. No, this is not a sonification, and it's very cool. I think you're going to like it, and I don't think anybody needs any hints. Just go out there and tell me if you know what it is. And also this week, if you've heard anything cool, please send it to me. You never know. I might just use it on the show. You can email me that sound at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Steve, we have a few things going on again.
We do. We have a new extravaganza is coming up in Arizona.
We have two extravaganzas in Arizona, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
But let me give you them in order of when they happen. Mm-hmm. So at 12 o'clock noon on April 23rd in Bethlehem, PA, we will be doing another SGU private show. This is when we record the show in front of a live audience. We absolutely promise that we do and say things during that live show that never make it to air. You will be the only person to hear it. And a lot of times there is something crazy or profound or really funny going on. We really like to have fun during those shows. So
no, seriously,
join us.
Seriously, we've started adding segments where like this is only for the live audience. This will never be in the podcast, and it's specifically designed to be like out of bounds for the podcast.
Also, sometimes George makes us cry.
Yeah,
it's happened. It happens. Mostly, he makes us laugh though. So yeah, George will be with us for that show. Then we have something called the No Show. Now, we did the No Show, I believe, in 2019, you know, back in before times.
In the before times,
This is a different show every time we do it. Usually there is music involved of some kind, and then we do some type of performance. So this time, George is going to be playing seven songs with George Robb. He'll have a backing band. I guarantee you that that's going to be fantastic, because the band that he has is amazing, and George is amazing himself. Mm. And then that night on April 23rd for the No Show, we will be doing a live version of our game show called Boomer versus Zoomer. This game show is a contest quiz show between the generations. We have four people, each from a different generation, and they are playing a head-to-head quiz game. And as an audience member, guess what? You get to play along. You actually get to play for real. You will be asked questions, and you will be answering those questions, and they will have an impact on the game. So I would love it if you joined us. Then we go to now the extravaganzas. We're going to be having an extravaganza in Phoenix, Arizona on July 15th, and we will be having an extravaganza in Tucson, Arizona on July 16th. All of these things can be found on our events page. That's theskepticsguide.org/events. And on top of that, we will be adding in two private shows for the Phoenix shows. So every time we do an extravaganza, we will be doing a private show at some point, either the day before or the day of. Those details will be coming soon, but you can see most of this information on our events page. Please join us. We just had a great time in New York and Boston, and we want to bring it to you.
And Jay. Maybe we could tell the nice folks out there what the difference between an extravaganza and a private show is.
Sure, Kara, no problem. The private show is a podcast recording of this exact podcast. The only difference is you're in the live audience and we're doing some things that you are the only people that will hear it. It's more interactive in a sense.
You
know,
yeah.
We definitely, you know, talk to the audience and everything. You get a chance to chat with us before or after the show. And in general, we're just, you know, having a lot of fun and it's the podcast. But the extravaganza, you know, it's a stage show. This is a completely different animal.
Yeah, it's like a variety game stage show. Totally different.
Yeah, the theme of the show is you can't trust your senses. You can't trust what your brain perceives. And we show you tons of examples of how you can't trust what you see, hear, and smell. Everything.
And we humiliate each other, basically.
We do. And then George, more accurately, George puts us into different, you know, live comedic bits where we have to do something. I'll give you an example. Like my favorite one is called Freeze Frame, where the audience will yell out suggestions for a movie. George will pick the movie. And then, you know, four of us have to freeze in position to try to get the fifth rogue who doesn't know what the movie is to guess what the movie is. And oh my God, I mean, some insane situations have come out of that bit, and mm-hmm. we love doing it. So we do a bunch of different games like that, and it's a great show. It's about an hour and 45 minutes, and you know, please join us if you haven't seen it. You know, we're getting incredible feedback. We'd really like you to come check it out for yourself.
And people have asked us, what are these VIP tickets I see for sale on there? So for the VIP, you get a swag bag, and you get to hang out with us for an hour, usually before the show. It depends on how we have to schedule it. You get pictures with us, you know, so that's like, which is typical, you know, for now, for like live shows, for there to be like an intense, you know, behind the stage meet and greet kind of extra stuff. So that's what that is.
Oh, and also preferred seating at the show.
You get preferred seating at the show. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So for people who are wondering, you know, if we do two cities that are near to one another, we design it in such a way that you could attend both an extravaganza and a private show. Mm-hmm. They're both completely different in your city. You could, mm-hmm. of course, come to the next city, too, but
the shows
design
will be
it
different.
So that you don't have to. Yeah.
Some people.
Yeah, right. No extravaganza is the same thing because we never run the same exact thing twice. Every show is completely different.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's do a very quick email. This one comes from Jacob from Tracy, California. And Jacob writes, "Hi, I saw this article and thought it was interesting. Normally you hear from religious fundamentalists that accepting evolution leads to genocide and all of that nonsense, but it's nice to have confirmation that that is not the case, and in fact accepting evolution is related to less bigotry. Makes me wonder then how much less bigotry there could be if everyone accepted evolution. Thanks for everything you do, Jacob." So, yeah, I read the article that he linked to, and it's actually a series of studies, pretty rigorously done. That where they look at, it's correlational, of course, but they're looking at a bunch of demographics as well as, you know, like things like religiosity and gender and age and all those things, but also do you accept evolution as an established scientific fact? And then they correlate that with attitudes and beliefs towards outgroups and racial groups and minorities and things like that. And they found a pretty strong correlation that cut across pretty much, they did this in multiple countries. So they cut across multiple countries and it stood out as a predictive factor, you know, that acceptance of evolution was negatively correlated with measures of bigotry. So again, these kinds of psychological studies are always complicated. There's always confounding factors, but it was, you know, a pretty robust signal that again, survived, you know, multiple different iterations. So, you know, it doesn't prove cause and effect, right? It doesn't prove that.
Absolutely not. Yeah. It could just be that people who are more likely to be scientific thinkers are already more open-minded, blah, 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 blah.
But it does, you know, it does contradict, you know, the, argument from final consequences, logical fallacy. Ooh. That is very common among evolution deniers, which is that believing in evolution is a moral hazard, right? If you believe in evolution, then you're going to, if you think that we're just animals, then you'll be morally loose and you'll do horrible things. And why would you do anything good?
Oh, I don't know.
It's the opposite. Yeah, it makes no sense anyway. It's like you clearly, it always says more about them than us. You know what I mean? It's like, mm-hmm. so you think without your religious belief, and your fear of hell, you'd be raping and pillaging your way through life. Is that what you really think you would be doing? Because I don't think that about myself.
Right. And I always think it's so funny when you used to hear that with the, like, what was it, like the preservation of the family movements, yeah, like all these like family values that were like anti-gay marriage and stuff. Like the minute it's legal, every man is just going to become gay. And yeah, it's like, right. Is that really what you believe?
Yeah, that's how it works.
And I do find it plausible that having this scientific outlook where you realize that, yeah, we're part of the animal kingdom, you know, there's nothing, you know, unique or spiritual about us, and that people are different. It does sort of make it, the perspective is more accepting and open.
Of course.
What I mean? So yeah. It even though this study doesn't prove cause and effect, it is certainly plausible. And it's not plausible that believing in evolution would somehow loosen your morals or make you a bad person. That's never been a plausible argument, in my opinion.
It's also not incompatible with being religious.
No, absolutely not. That's why, and it was an independent variable, separate religiosity. So religion didn't, in and of itself, predict this. It was specifically acceptance of evolution. Interesting.
Yeah.
All right, we have an interesting interview coming up, so let's go to that interview now. Joining us now is Dr. John Z. Kiss. John, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So, and John, you are the Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences and professor in the Department of Biology at the University of North Carolina in Greensboro. And we're having you on to talk to us today because of your work with NASA and space plants. Tell us a little bit about what you do.
Sure. So I've been very fortunate. I'm a plant physiologist, and I've worked with NASA actually for over 25 years. I'm interested in using microgravity as a unique research tool to study some basic processes in plants. The long-term implications of my research and the reason NASA funds it is they're very interested in the use of plants for life support on long range space missions and things like colonies on the moon and Mars. And I've had 8 spaceflight experiments studying aspects of plant development in space, the interaction between phototropism and gravitropism, looking at gene expression in plants, most recently at sort of the moon and Mars levels, as well as the microgravity levels.
So is a lot of your work just focusing on getting plants to grow in low gravity?
Not really. I mean, it's actually my work. I'm interested in kind of 2 things. Tropism, so directed growth in response, particularly to light, and the effects of different gravity levels on gene expression. A lot of people focus on growing larger crop plants for use and life support, but I'm really interested in these very basic questions about plants.
So it's more about like what the effect of gravity is on the development of the plants themselves. Like in microgravity, which genes get expressed and how different is it from developing on Earth?
Yes, that's a pretty good summary. And, you know, to take that a bit further, you know, we actually know a lot about plants in microgravity. Plants were part of the earliest Soviet U.S. space missions where, you know, they brought up seeds and did simple experiments. Most recently, what I've been focused on are these effects of plants when we're looking at the moon and Mars level of gravity. And there's very little known about that. And again, in the long term, NASA is very interested in those questions. So in our most recent experiments on the ISS, we actually used a lab facility, which had a centrifuge. So we could do the experiments in microgravity with the centrifuge off. We could also do moon and Mars level of gravity as well as a 1G control.
So what's the big takeaway that you, as you understand it now in terms of micro and minimal gravity on the growth of plants and gene expression? What's the big takeaway?
Well, here's a really interesting takeaway from our research, I think, and it has some interesting implications for long-term NASA missions. Let's take a kind of a simple approach. So by definition, we're Earth-centric. We'll say that the gravity level on Earth is 1G. The moon and Mars are smaller planets. So the gravity level on the moon is 1/6 G. And we actually know that, like, those Apollo pictures, those astronauts to the moon, they're hopping around, you know, with a 300-pound backpack. That's pretty hard to do. But in 1/6 G, you could do it. And then on Mars, it's 3/8 G. What our research has shown is that in terms of the plant physiology, the parameters that we've studied, the moon gravity is pretty much like microgravity. However, the Mars gravity, the 3/8 G, is pretty much like the Earth nominal gravity.
Okay.
And what that means is that, you know, if we're going to have a greenhouse on the moon or Mars, it could be quite different. There could be a lot more complications on the moon where the gravity isn't really enough to make it Earth nominal, where the 3/8 G on Mars is enough for the plants.
Yeah, so plants growing on Mars will be fine, basically. They'll develop like they would on Earth. But the moon, I guess, is below the threshold in terms of the gravity, and it might as well be microgravity at that point.
Yeah, it's a good way to put it, yes.
So it sounds like you're doing essentially the basic science research. You know, has there been any collaboration or any discussion? Because, you know, this is why I assume NASA's interested in this, in using this information to genetically engineer plants to make them grow better on the moon or Mars. You know, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, that's a great question. The short answer is no. I mean, I think when we're talking about genetically engineering plants, the most common theme in that kind of research is in terms of medicines. So, if you're going to go to Mars, you're going to bring your basic medicines, your antibiotics and other things. But there are, you know, certain medicines you might need, and the pharmacy is pretty far away. So the research on that has focused being able to program plants to make whatever medicine you might need at the time. And that will work for a lot of things. In terms of adjusting them for the gravity level, that's a really good question. But as far as I know, there hasn't been very much consideration of that.
But is the bottom line that plants will do fine, basically, even if we don't tweak them to be optimized for different, you know, gravity strengths? They'll grow. They'll be fine.
You're talking about Moon or Mars now?
Well, you tell me either both. You just tell me which. Tell me for each one.
First of all, I always want to be, you know, I want to carefully give you the caveats. I would say based on the parameters we've studied, and there are other parameters that others need to study, we really need to do more work at these reduced gravity levels. And we still have an opportunity with the ISS because there are a number of centrifuges. But basically, again, the gravity sensing, gravity is a really important thing in terms of evolution and life on Earth. It's a ubiquitous force. For a plant, it's really important to know which way is up and down. So plants are kind of overbuilt. They're really sensitive to gravity. So it doesn't surprise me that the gravity level on Mars is sufficient and similar to Earth. But yeah, the moon is below the threshold.
So what happens if a plant doesn't develop because there isn't it doesn't sense a sufficient gravity well? What do they do?
Well, so we studied actually these effects like a sort of a competition experiment between, I have to take a step back, between phototropism and gravitropism. And, you know, going back to phototropism, that's a word people might not be familiar with, but they're very familiar with the phenomenon. So plants exhibit directed growth in response to light. So, for instance, if you take your house plants, you need to keep them on a windowsill. If you have them on a windowsill, you need to rotate them because they grow toward the light. So, again, on Mars, all those phototropism, those behaviors are like Earth. But on the moon, they're like in microgravity, where phototropism takes on a greater prominence because there isn't really an effective gravity vector. You could take this a little bit, make an extreme statement that you really can't do a pure phototropism experiment on Earth because gravity and light always interact. But in microgravity, if you take away the gravity, you could study pure light effects. And again, the microgravity is like the moon. So, I mean, they will grow on the moon. So one thing you could sort of extrapolate from our results is, you know, the lights might take a more prominent role in orienting the plants because there isn't enough gravity. But what we don't know is like other physiological effects, like transport processes in plants, other physiological aspects, what it would do to photosynthesis and things like that. That has not been studied yet.
John, do you think that we would have to use some type of centrifuge on the moon to make this whole thing work? Or what do you think that they'll do?
No, I think you could orient it with lights. And, you know, since this podcast has skeptics in the title, one thing I'm skeptical of is NASA always sells the moon as a test bed for Mars.
Mm-hmm.
And the more I think about it, the reason I think they say that it's easier to go to the moon, it's only 4 days away versus Mars. But I don't think I don't think the technologies are directly exportable to Mars. And they were always saying that, but I'm very skeptical of that claim. Mm. I mean, there are advantages and disadvantages of growing plants on Mars compared to the moon, but I guess some technologies, but I don't think it's a really great test bed the way it's promoted.
Is the goal here to grow plants for food, oxygen, and possibly medicinal purposes? Or is it going to be like, is the same plant going to be used for multiple vectors? Or would you be like, okay, this is our oxygen creation. You know, this plant creates oxygen. This plant we eat, and this plant we'll use for medication.
Well, I really like that question. I talk a lot to people about this, and no one's ever asked me that. I think it's probably going to be different plants for different things. If I could take a step back, I mean, one of the things you're getting at is plants are really important in bioregenerative life support. And in low Earth orbit, it doesn't matter that much. When you go to the moon, it matters more. And Mars, it really matters a lot because the quickest we get to Mars is 6 or 7 months. And the fastest round trip mission I know of is about 3 years. And that only occurs, you know, when the planets are aligned. And we really need plants then on Mars. And one of the things I find fascinating, like, you hear Elon Musk talking about what he wants to do. I think the general public sees the problem of going to Mars as like this engineering problem, that it's really like, let's build that damn big rocket to get there. And yeah, we do need a big rocket to get there. But I think if we had the big rocket today, we couldn't go because there's so many unknown that, the questions that are important to solve are the biological questions.
Yeah.
We don't really understand the biology to go to Mars. And again, the focus is build a big rocket, you know, and, you know, if we don't have all the biological questions answered, it's just not going to work.
John, can I ask you a technical question? A couple of times you mentioned using a centrifuge. Are you talking about using a centrifuge on Earth to simulate low gravity?
International Space Station. So there's a couple of facilities that have centrifuges, and I used this. It was actually the facility I used was built by the European Space Agency, and it had a centrifuge. So again, you could do the experiments, centrifuge off. It's a microgravity experiment. Spin it to the moon level, spin it to the Mars level.
Gotcha.
And spin it at a 1G control. Now on Earth, it's not going to really help you because we have the 1G, then it's hyper-G.
Unless you want to simulate growing plants on Jupiter.
I mean, yeah, you would think that, you know, holding a plant, you know, kind of connects you to Earth. And there is something about it. You know, they say that, you know, hiking and the outdoor activities have a real psychological benefit. And I absolutely don't doubt it. So I could see that. You know, I would imagine the people that get to be walking through, you know, the room with all the plants, like that's probably one of the best jobs you could have if you're off planet.
Right, right. I actually, again, used to be a little bit skeptical, but I bought in because just talking to the astronauts, I heard this lecture by one of the ISS astronauts, Don Pettit. He called, he had his space zucchini. He had some seeds left over and he grew them hydroponically in like a baggie, and he carried the plants around all over the space station, became like his pet. If you Google that space zucchini, you'll there was a whole blog on that, how important that was to him.
Now, we all saw pictures of on the ISS of the astronauts growing plants and growing, like, I think the red lettuce that they ate, which is, I think, the first plants in space that they consumed. Were those, do you know, first of all, were they part of your experiments, and were they grown in just microgravity, or did they use centrifuges for those?
No, that's sort of a problem. So kind of an interesting thing is, so I've been fortunate, 7 of my 8 projects were in collaboration with the European Space Agency, and they have a module, this Columbus module, but, you know, they all collaborate and share facilities. But in general, NASA has not had very many centrifuges, but the Europeans, the Japanese, they have the Kigu module, they have several centrifuges. For a scientist, that's a really important control, having a 1G control in space, because some things in the past that were attributed to microgravity were secondary effects or poor ventilation or all sorts of things. But no, that lettuce, they just grew them in microgravity. And that was a colleague of mine, Joya Massa, who works at Kennedy Space Center. She did a bunch of lettuce experiments.
Well, John, thank you so much for talking to us about your research. This is something that we definitely follow closely, you know, leading up to, you know, the Artemis missions going back to the moon. We're all anxiously waiting to see if they're ever actually going to get to Mars in our lifetime. We're skeptical too, but hopeful. But we're hopeful. We'll see what happens. So thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you. And well, also at my university, a lot of scientists are fans of your podcast.
Oh, cool. Thanks.
That's awesome.
Awesome.
So they were impressed that I was coming on.
Yeah. You could brag to them that you were on the show.
Tell them that we thought you were awesome.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 real and 1 fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week, something that just came out that we didn't talk about yet, the IPCC 2022 report.
Oh, no.
I'm sure you guys have read all, 900 pages or whatever it was?
Every time I read all 900, you're right.
Absolutely. So if you dig deep, deep down into the report, pull out some facts.
Oh boy.
We'll see if you guys can recognize which of these facts is real and which one is fake. You ready?
Let's do it.
All right.
Bob's ready.
Here we go. Item number 1, carbon intensity, CO2 from fossil fuel combustion and industrial processes per unit primary energy, decreased by 3% per year since 2010, mostly due to rapid increases in wind and solar energy. Item number 2, in 2019, 22% of worldwide greenhouse gas emissions came from agriculture and forestry, greater than the transportation sector at 15%. And item number 3, 83% of cumulative CO2 emissions since 1850 were produced prior to 1990. Evan, go first.
Let's see. About the carbon intensity, it decreased by 3% since year 2010 due to rapid increases in wind and solar energy. Well, I like that. That's good. And, we talk so much about, warmest year after year after year that we kind of maybe sometimes lose sight of some of the impact that we are having in a good way. And this term carbon intensity, which I couldn't, so clearly define, but I think the way you put it here, Steve, I think this is right.
How much carbon does it cost to do stuff?
So we're getting the same returns on less carbon is what it sounds like. But again, 3% decrease since 2010 and the rapid increase in wind and solar energy. I think that's right. Next one. So this was the year 2019, where 22% of worldwide greenhouse gas emissions came from agriculture and forestry. And that was greater than the transportation sector at 15%. Well, okay. I don't see why that would necessarily be fiction. It might be, but I can't point to something in here that is screaming at me like, yeah, this is definitely science. Yeah, this is definitely fiction. So that one's right on the border. The last one, about 83% of cumulative CO2 emissions since 1850 were produced prior to 1990. So this one strikes me as a bit non-intuitive. Boy, we were burning a lot of coal back then, but we're still burning a lot of coal today. And gee whiz, you know, fossil fuels. There wasn't so much in the way of fossil fuels in 1850. It was coal that was doing it. And agriculture, I imagine. But then you got to compare that. My gosh, that much. That's scary in a way. If that one turns out to be science, that's kind of a scary thought, if you ask me. Well, I guess I'll have to go with, therefore, I'll say that one's the fiction. 83% of cumulative CO2 emissions since 1850 produced prior to 1990.
Okay, Bob.
All right, so the first one, yeah, 3% decrease sounds about right since 2010. Maybe 3% is a little high, but this doesn't sound egregious. The third one here, this 83% of cumulative CO2 emissions produced prior to 1990, I'm just going to say whatever, that's science. And I'm, because what was rubbing me the wrong way was the second one, greater that cumulative agriculture and forestry greater than transportation. I think if I remember doing research for the book, that transportation was higher and really dominated. Oh, God, I did so much research for that book. It's just all blending together in a big mush in my head. But yeah, it's rubbing me the wrong way. Plus, the way you said it made me think you were lying. So I'll say fiction.
Okay, Kara.
On which one, Bob?
The second one. Yeah.
Forestry greater than transportation.
I was already feeling that way, and then Bob kind of echoed exactly what I think. I know that methane is horrible, but I also know that carbon dioxide is horrible. And I do think that unless you're tripping us up on, like, it's not the transportation sector, but like all industrial greenhouse gas emissions. Yeah. But I still think transportation sector is higher than agriculture. I definitely think it's higher than forestry. And I think it's higher than both combined. So even if the 22% is correct, 15% of our entire greenhouse gas emissions being from the transportation sector, that sounds unbelievably low to me. So, yeah, although the 83% of cumulative CO2 emissions since 1850 were produced prior to 1990 sounds bananas, I also think we didn't have that much regulation back in the day.
Yeah,
and so that one, things were super dirty and we didn't even think about how to clean them up. And now we do. Yeah. So I'm going to go with Bob on this one and say it's the transportation sector one. That number I think is too low.
And Jay.
That's funny because that's the one I thought seemed about right.
Hmm.
I mean, agriculture and forestry seem, I always thought that they were like the big polluters.
Cow farts.
Okay. I mean, I my gut's telling me different on that one. So I'm going to move on here. 83% of cumulative CO2 emissions since 1850 were produced prior to 1990. That's a lot. You would think that, you know, we would be blowing that away in recent years. And then this first one, I don't like though, because, you know, carbon intensity has decreased by 3% per year since 2010, mostly due to rapid increases in wind and solar energy. I don't think they decreased by 3% each year at all. I really, really don't think that that's correct. So I'm going to say that one is the fiction.
Oh, boy.
Wow, all spread out.
All spread out. Wow. Why don't we take this in reverse order? We'll start with number 3. 83% of cumulative CO2 emissions since 1850 were produced prior to 1990. Evan, was it you who thought this one was the fiction?
Yes.
And
not anymore, but
is science. This is science. Yeah, I mean, I picked all of these because I thought they were a little surprising, right? And I was surprised by that, although, you know, we did burn a lot of coal back then. But yeah, only 17% of our current, you know, our cumulative CO2 is since 1990. Obviously, the amount of CO2 that we've been releasing has significantly increased, you know, over the last century, although it has somewhat plateaued recently. Obviously, the pandemic is an anomaly. It decreased during the pandemic. And
we need more pandemics.
Yeah.
No.
It tends to dip when there's a big economic recession, et cetera. But, you know, it tends to follow those trends. But yeah, so, you know, just a thought that was a little bit surprising. But yeah, we've been emitting carbon for a long time. Remember, they figured out that CO2 was going to cause climate change back then, you know, back in the
Darwin's
late
days.
19th century. Yeah.
Darwin's
it's already
days.
Happening. All right, let's go to number 2. In 2019, 22% of worldwide greenhouse gas emissions came from agriculture and forestry, greater than the transportation sector at 15%. Bob and Kara, you think this one is the fiction. Jay, you think that this one is science. And this one is science.
Good job, Jay. Good job, Jay.
Wow. Good job, Jay.
Yeah. Thank you. I thought that was a little surprising. I thought the transportation sector was higher. But again, this is worldwide. Yeah. We're biased. You might be thinking of U.S. numbers where the transportation sector
would be higher. I'm thinking of like rapid car sales in India and China. Like,
yeah, but you got to think we're feeding 7.5 billion people. The agriculture is huge. It's massive. And this is also all forestry as well. So, the number's higher. Of course, it's, you know, the industrial sources are higher and energy production is a lot higher as well. Yeah, but I thought that was a little surprising. Which means that carbon intensity, CO2 from fossil fuel combustion industrial processes per unit primary energy, decreased by 3% per year since 2010, mostly due to rapid increases in wind and solar energy, is the fiction. There are two things wrong with this. The first is that it was 0.3% per year. Not 3% per year. And it was mostly due to the switch from coal to natural gas.
Not
wind and solar. In fact, that's
not making a dent at all.
The best thing we got going on in terms of reducing CO2 is switching from coal to natural gas.
Woo-hoo.
They're both fossil fuels, but coal is just so bad. Yeah. Getting off of coal as soon as possible has got to be the priority, even if it's natural gas. But of course, then we have to get off natural gas and go to nuclear and go to renewables, wind and solar and hydrothermal, et cetera.
Hydrothermal.
Yeah. Exactly. The big story, you know, coming out of this report was that it's already too late kind of reporting. I don't know if you guys heard that. But essentially, they said, yeah, we're basically like already on track to blow through 1.5C. Like there's almost nothing we could do at this point. We've already done it. Like we've already pulled the fossil fuel out of the ground that's going to get us past 1.5C. So we could essentially give up that goal. And if we want to keep warming below 2C, 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, we have to rapidly increase our transition to renewables, to low carbon sources, and other mitigation efforts, like start pulling some CO2 out of the air. It's like, so we're under the gun for 2.0, and we've already pretty much are on course to blow past 1.5 this century.
I think we need to focus on keeping it below 3.
No, I think below 2 is still doable, and I don't think we should give up on that
humans
too fast.
We're talking about humans, right?
I hear you, but they also said that we can do it with existing technology. We can do it with existing technology.
I don't care.
Need even,
you said it's going to take to keep it under
a massive effort.
It's going to acceleration. Think about those words.
Cooperation.
Not going to happen.
It's not going to happen if we stay on the course we're currently on. We have to rapidly accelerate the transition to a zero carbon, a net zero infrastructure. Totally. I would not bet on that. I wouldn't put I wouldn't put money on that right now. Absolutely. But I don't think we should give up on it. That's what I'm saying. That even if it's an aspirational goal, it's not impossible, and so we should shoot for it. And Bob, you never know. I'm serious. Sometimes political will shifts in unpredictable ways, and suddenly, something that was impossible a decade earlier is suddenly unavoidable today. You know what I mean? Like generations change, and it's in our lifetime, in my opinion, like the one thing that I think really demonstrated that was the shifting attitudes on homosexuality. Like we lived through the don't ask, don't tell period, where that was sort of the best we could do. And, the right was pretty much unified in being anti-gay rights and the left was split on it. And then a decade later, it was flipped. Like, it was dramatic change, within a generation, within 20 years. So.
Yeah, but it's still not. That's the
still
problem.
Not
like,
great.
It's a dramatic change.
It's just a different world. It's just a different world. It's not, again, of course, like with climate change, it's not going to be like everyone's going to go along with it, but it'll be, but I'm just saying it is possible. I think right now it sort of feels like we're just not quite getting the political will to really do something about it. But it wouldn't shock me if in 10 years or 20 years we look back and the political will is dramatically different than it is today. Will it be enough? Will it be fast enough?
Who knows?
Not for 1.5, but I wouldn't give up on 2.0. Plus, also, as the technology improves, again, this is all with today's technology. As the technology improves, I think certain things are just going to happen. Like, I think electric cars are just going to take over, you know?
Yeah, they already are.
Yeah, and yeah. Wind and solar is going to you know, dramatically increase. And the technology for grid storage and for managing the grid is here. It's happening, you know, there's no reason why that's not going to be put into place. So there's a certain amount that's going to happen without the political will. And if the political will shifts, I think, you know, we may be surprised on things, how quickly things get moving once they get moving. But it's, you know, we shouldn't count on it fixing itself. We have to continue to work towards, you know, educating people about these facts and what it's going to take. Also, just fighting the misinformation and the what I think is the incorrect framing that is rampant in the political discussion about we're going to ruin the economy and spend all this money. It's like, no, actually, we're going to save the economy and we're going to invest all this money, which we're going to get paid back tenfold down the road.
Yeah.
You know, you have to just completely reframe this, but we'll see.
You're adorable.
I know. I tend to be more of an optimist, but it's partly because I think that optimism and pessimism are partly self-fulfilling prophecies. And so it's, you know, I tend to err on the side of optimism because I think it's functionally better.
So maybe we're balancing each other out.
Better headspace, that's for sure.
All right. Good job, Jay.
Yeah,
thanks. Solid solo win.
It just seemed easy, Steve, you know?
Yeah.
I guess who's going first next
week?
Nice.
It was a solo win, and you went last, so the other guys failed to persuade you to the answer.
Yeah. Don't act like going last is harder. It's way easier when you go last.
Totally.
All
and he
right.
still struck out on his own, so that's a good job, Jay.
Yeah, it is.
But it is hard to go out totally on your own.
Good work, boys.
I see you guys struggle with that all the time, where you're like, you're the last one to go, and like, should I just go with the crowd? You usually do, although you usually right when you do that. All right.
For the reason.
Evan, give us a quote.
I'll give you the quote, and then I'll tell you about who said it in the context, all right?
All right.
I simply wish that in a matter which so closely concerns the well-being of the human race, no decision shall be made without all the knowledge which a little analysis and calculation can provide. So I'll tell you first, this was suggested by listener Bruce from New Jersey suggested this quote, and he wrote, "Hey, Evan, I'm reading a book called The Art of More, How Mathematics Created Civilization, and came across this quote from mathematician Daniel Bernoulli as he was applying calculus topics to try and see if vaccines were a good idea for the populace." And we are talking about the 1700s. So I think that's very cool.
Yeah, I like that quote. But you do have to put it into context.
Yes, yeah. That's right.
Oh, yeah.
Using a little analysis and calculation to decide if vaccines are a good idea. What an idea.
Chin scratcher.
That might catch on someday. Give it a few hundred more years.
Yeah, right. Maybe by the 22nd century we'll figure it out.
All right, guys. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure, man.
Thanks, Steve.
Yeah, Steve.
And until next week. This is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.